Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, April 11th, day two of our spring fundraising campaign. Are forever chemicals in our drinking water? Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has set new levels of the contaminants in our drinking water systems. So what does it mean for customers of the Honolulu Board of Water Supply? We Hanahoa story about the Haiku Stairs, or the Stairway to Heaven, in light of the announcement that it will be dismantled at the end of the month. We share the story of the architect of the structure that was built as part of the Coast Guard Omega Radio Communication Station. And in a nod to National Pet Day, we talk to a dog psychologist about man's best friend, why training is just as important for the owner as it is for the dog. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. This is The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Environmental Protection Agency just announced new maximum levels of contaminants in our drinking water. The new rules cover what's known as forever chemicals, known as PFAS. There are nearly 15,000 different types, and the new levels only cover six, but it's a start. The chemicals take a long time to break down in the environment and can be traced to things like pesticides and firefighting foam, as well as other everyday items from waterproofing to food containers. We talked to Erwin Kawata. He's the Honolulu Board of Water Supply's deputy manager, and he's worked there for some 40 years. Kawata says the Board of Water Supply began testing our water wells in 2020, anticipating the new rules. It has found low levels of PFAS, about 50% under those new limits. Here's Kawata.
We are encouraged by the results. We're seeing that we only have about eight pumping stations that have had some PFAS detections that are, at this point, maybe about 50% of the regulated amounts. And it's just going to require continued vigilance on our part to monitor and to respond in the event we see any of these levels rise to the point where they exceed the drinking water standards.
Can you tell us what wells they were found in?
Sure. We have wells in Ainakoa, Waipahu, Makakilo, Moanalua, Waipio Heights, or the Waipio Gentry area, Halawa, Kaamilo, which is near the Aiea area, and one of our wells in Pearl City.
So at this point, low levels below the, I guess, actionable levels that were announced by the EPA, but we just need to take a closer look to make sure these things don't spike.
Yeah, that's correct. So at levels that are below the maximum contaminant limits that EPA announced yesterday, six different kinds of PFAS. And at this point, we just need to continue to test and monitor and remain vigilant.
Have we been testing for all those six?
Yes, we've been doing it since 2020. The funding, it comes from what is called the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and it provides funds to address emerging contaminants. And PFAS is an emerging contaminant. And so utilities that are doing either studies, treatment studies, to understand how they need to treat their water or actually build the treatment to reduce high levels of PFAS, or in some cases actually doing testing, can apply for this funding to support all of that work. So we've done the same thing. We've hired a consultant that's going to help us assess, you know, what is the impact of PFAS on our sources, especially those that we have detected the PFAS. And we are actually planning to do some treatment studies because we want to stay ahead of these levels that we are currently recording, because if at some point they start to increase and we want to install treatment, we want to be well prepared to understand what kind of treatment is going to be needed, the treatment facility that needs to be designed and actually constructed, because all of that requires time. So we want to start that now. And so we've actually applied for funding through the BIL, or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, to do that work. And that's going to be done in the next 2 to 3 years.
And as we learn more about the forever chemicals, you know, we understand that they're everywhere. But Do we have any indication whether those eight locations are close to, let's say, you know, military installations or former agriculture plantations?
That's one of the reasons why we're doing the study, to understand if there may be any relationships to other activities going on near our wells, and if there's any interrelationship between those two activities in our wells and the detections that we are recording. So that's part of the work that we're doing.
And so these are monthly tests that are underway?
Under the regulations, utilities have to do quarterly. So you have to take a sample of the water that's served to the public and test it for every 3 months. You do that for a full year. And then based on that data, you determine whether you're in compliance or not. If you have, you know, levels that are exceed the standard, you have to do treatment. And then from there, you continue to do the testing based on those levels. So if the levels are remain high, then you continue to do quarterly. If they remain stable, then the regulatory agency, in our case, Hawaii Department of Health, they could potentially reduce the monitoring frequency to once every 3 years. So we're not going to really know what our future monitoring frequency is going to be until we do this initial, what is called the initial monitoring work, testing.
Are there any plans to test for anything else? You know, I know you folks are putting in some new monitoring wells just, you know, around the Red Hill area just because of that fuel contamination. But do you have any plans for testing any other contaminants?
Well, our testing for PFAS is going to continue. I mean, there's currently 6 regulated PFAS, but there are many more PFASs. So we're doing about 29 different types of PFAS on a regular basis that we've been doing since 2020. So we're going to continue to do that. As it relates to monitoring wells that we're installing related to Red Hill and understanding the impact of, you know, past releases on the aquifer, we're going to continue to install monitoring wells, and we'll be testing for petroleum contaminants as well as PFAS also, because each monitoring well is an opportunity to collect a water sample from the environment. And so we'll do some PFAS testing on those samples also.
With all the heightened awareness about our drinking water, I know just at home, I've been making an effort to unscrew the aerators on my faucets and make sure those little screens are clean, or I change them out just for, I guess, my own, you know, personal confidence that if there's anything that comes through, sand or whatever, that the tap water is as clean as it can be.
Yeah. You know, I guess over the last several years, you know, with things like PFAS and the issues with respect to Red Hill, all of those are providing more awareness about the impact that the environment or practices within the environment can have on our resources. So that's something that is good. And what it means is continued vigilance, continued testing, and responding to any contaminants that we might be finding as part of that monitoring.
I know it's always a good reminder to the general public, you know, not to waste our precious resource. You know, check for leaks, just those basic housekeeping things that we should be doing on a regular basis.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, yes, we have a resource that's extremely precious, and we want to make sure it's sustainable into the future. And so we want to preserve, protect it, and not waste it. And certainly at the same time, recognize that what we do in the environment can have an impact on our resources. So managing our waste, proper disposal, to the extent possible, recycling, all of those things are going to help reduce the impact or demand on our resources.
Well, Erwin, I really appreciate you carving out time for us. But is there anything else you want to leave with our listeners?
No, except, you know, to thank the community for saving water. We're seeing some good results. And so we ask people to continue to do that and use water wisely. And we appreciate the community's help.
Yeah, I mean, we are going to be getting into the summer season, the drier season.
Yes, we are. Summer is approaching. And so we'll be going out again with conservation messages. We've seen the public has done a great job in the past, and we're sure that they're going to continue to do that in helping us keep our sources protected and of course, sustainable into the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Erwin. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
And that was Erwin Kawata, the Honolulu Board of Water Supply's deputy manager. He says the city and county has been testing for dozens of different types of forever chemicals over the last several years and recently found low levels of the PFAS in 8 of our drinking water wells and will continue its monitoring. In full disclosure, the Board of Water Supply is an HPR underwriter.
So Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
What to do about the Stairway to Heaven? We've been wringing our hands over that one for a couple decades. Well, the city announced yesterday it will start removing the structure, also known as the Haiku Stairs, later this month. Today we are sharing a story that we aired in 2021 about the architect of the stairs. Daniel Kairis was from Kaimuki and was a graduate of St. Louis School. He was said to be in the very first class of first graders there. He got a job at the Pearl Harbor Shipyard in an apprentice draftsmanship program and worked his way up and became an architect. One of his projects as a civilian architect for the Navy was designing the stairs for the Coast Guard Omega Station. That was back in the 1940s. When Kairis finally retired from Pearl Harbor after 36 years, he moved to Maui, where he died at the age of 93. We talked to his son, Michael, who now lives in Maine, and he recalled that his dad considered the construction of the stairs a mission accomplished.
I remember sitting with him at the dining room table one day. This was in Haiku, Maui. And we started talking about it, and he explained that he was, I don't want to say in charge, but he was designated the designer for the stairway to the radio station. And I remember him talking about how intrigued he was and that he had trouble sleeping at night because he was so, I'm trying to find the right word for it. It was so exhilarating for him to go up there and take in that view and be a part of such a big project that, you know how you feel when you have all this inside energy and it's just exhilarating and you can't take your mind off what you're thinking. And that's how the conversation got started. And then he was telling me about how all the parts had to be galvanized. And he just lit up when he started talking about it. So I know it meant a lot to him. And it wasn't long after that I started researching into how to get a hold of either an original or some of his drawings that he did. So it started with just a conversation in his house and seeing him light up about it.
And so talk about how you went about doing the research to get those drawings.
Well, it started out, I contacted his section at Pearl Harbor where he worked, and they explained to me that they don't keep those types of drawings, but that I could try a certain archive in Washington. And if I remember right, this is almost 20 years ago, they may have given me a number or a name of an organization which I contacted at the time, and that led me to the right institution that actually housed the set of drawings that made up Haiku Stairs.
So you corresponded with them for a while and then were able to get the drawings blown up?
Yes. And they also sent me a CD. At the time, I was able to put it into the computer and look at it. It was comprised of black and white photos of the construction going on and all the different aspects of it. But yes, I was in communication with them for quite a while. I think it took a couple of months to finally get the right people that were able to locate what I was looking for. It took a little while. It wasn't just something that happened overnight.
And so you had this in your mind, you wanted to get a copy of that for him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was nothing in the house that he had that referred to that big project. And I know it consumed a lot of his time when he worked on it because he often worked at home too. And I think that was part of that project. He had a drawing table set up in their bedroom against the wall, and he was in there a lot working on that. He's very meticulous, and he has a lot of stamina and concentration and focus when he's really into his work. You know, of course, to his benefit, but he did spend a lot of time on that project.
Well, I was talking to, I think, your youngest sister, and she said she didn't know growing up that her dad was the guy behind the stairs. I mean, growing up in Kailua, yeah. Right?
Right. He never talked about it. He never really talked about it. It wasn't until I was much older, I was already into my career, and I realized that he was a main factor in that project. And at some point, I either got contacted by John Flanagan or one of those guys that represents the Friends of the Haiku Stairs, and they were, I guess, trying to reach my dad to see if he could come over for, like, not so much a tour, but to meet them and discuss how everything was put together and maybe go up to the site. But I certainly remember him. And then, of course, at my dad's funeral, I met John Flanagan and one other individual that was active in the history of that project.
Yeah, I think it was Vern Ansdell that was there at that service as well.
I think so. That rings a bell, yeah.
So you managed to get a copy of the drawings, mm-hmm. and I understand mm-hmm. you presented it to your dad on one of his birthdays as a surprise.
Yeah, it was his 80th birthday, so that was right around 2002. And it's about 18-inch by 24-inch copy of the drawing. And it's quite detailed. On the bottom legend, it says there were four. This particular drawing, which was number 709278, was sheet 4 of 4. So there were other drawings, but for some reason, either this was the only one they could come up with, or this was the one that made the most sense to me, so I selected it. I just can't remember the exact details of why I picked this one, but it's a nice drawing, and it depicts quite a bit. It depicts three distinct sections of the ladder section. There's a type A ladder section, and that is, you know how the terrain there is. There's parts that are somewhat level, and then it's steep, and then levels off again, and it's steep. Anyway, that particular drawing for type A depicts level ground to 30 degrees of inclination, which is quite steep. The drawing that depicts type B is 30 degree inclination to 60 degrees. And then there's a section C, which is 60 degrees and over as far as inclination. That's really steep. And in the drawing, there's fastening details, and there's a series of step plates that are attached, little drawings of step plates attached horizontally to the stringers that make up the rails and the ladder. And then there's alternate anchors. This thing is so detailed. I mean, the intricate work that went into making this.
What did he think when you presented him with these drawings?
He had a real surprised look on his face. It almost seemed like it was somewhat of a little bit of a shock, as if to say, where did you get this? And I explained to him, you know, that it was a gift because of his exuberance over our discussion over the project. Was just really happy to have it, and he hung it in the hallway in his house in Haiku on Maui. And it was after his passing that I was able to get it so that it didn't just disappear. Or I tend to hang on to old things like my great-grandparents' trunk from the Azores and my dad's stamp collection. So anyway, this was just another thing from him that was really meaningful to me, so I was able to hang on to it. And I have it in my wall in my, I guess you call it a den downstairs.
And so did your father express, I don't know, his opinion about what to do with the stairs when this controversy was raging? Because it's only been going now for, what, more than 3 decades?
Not really. I remember him basically saying that it was built for one intention, and that intention was fulfilled. And I know he said it was unfortunate that it would fall into disrepair, because something of that nature, you have to maintain it. And it was being used for purposes other than what it was originally meant for. So he expressed that, but not so much in disappointment. It's just that was the reality of it. It was his project that he worked on, and it was done for a purpose, for a reason, and it was met. And then after that, it's just a matter of just letting it go.
And your dad is buried at the Kaneohe Veterans Cemetery just down there.
Yeah.
You know, so
my little sister Anne lives right across the highway from where he's buried.
Yeah. So, I mean, if he's looking up there at the Stairway to Heaven, that's his baby.
Yeah, we talked about that the day of his service. It was right there across the way and into the valley. And he thought so highly of that valley, it just intrigued him. And I can see why he lost sleep over it. It wasn't out of stress or strain of the job. It was just so beautiful. It just really, really touched him. He just came alive with being up there.
That was Michael Kyrus, a son of Daniel Kyrus, who was the architect behind the Haiku Stairs. Daniel was a longtime civilian architect at Pearl Harbor. He died in 2016 and is buried at the State Veterans Cemetery just below the stairs.
Happy National Pet Day! Did you know that 62% of Americans own pets, with the majority owning at least one dog? And while humans have had dogs as pets since forever, much has changed in our understanding of them and our relationship with them in recent decades. In fact, according to the Pew Research Center, most pet owners today consider their pets as much a part of their family as a human member. It's those kinds of changes that prompted the conversations Russell Subiona to check in with Hawaii Island dog trainer and dog psychologist Carl Ogus.
It seems like dog training has evolved over the years. I don't have any dogs now, but I had several growing up and a few as an adult. And many of the techniques for training dogs that people told me to use back then seem kind of brutish and how you described heavy-handed today.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit more about your training method? You described it as how a mother would treat her pups. Can you give some examples and go into a little bit more detail of how that works?
Sure. One of the things dogs are very good at is understanding the body language of other dogs. And they're a little bit less good at understanding humans. But in the case of individual dogs, that's most often the fault of the human for not using their body language in a way that seems natural and coherent to a dog. So what the dogs are going to understand is a simpler logic than that which comes naturally to humans, since we are primates and we're very highly evolved primates. And we have many more social strategies than dogs do. So the most common theme is when you want to establish a prohibition, for instance, the dog is not allowed to get up onto the table and try to take any food from a table or a counter. You want to essentially prohibit that behavior. You want to establish a rule that says you're not going to ever do this, whether I'm around or not. Now, that requires that the rule is internalized in the dog's own psychological set of values and expectations, such that they treat that countertop or that tabletop as if it were, in a sense, specially prohibited, almost magically so. So the approach that I would use is when the dog starts to focus on the food that's on the table, you have your first choice. You can start your communication that's not allowed at that point, or you can wait until they do something a little bit more, like if they get excited, their forehead wrinkles towards the middle so that there are little noticeable lines. Usually it depends on the fur, but you can see the motion. That shows that they're getting excited. You jump in and vocalize to the dog in a way that earns the dog's eye contact. So either by voice or with some dogs, even by other means, like shaking some coins in a plastic bottle that makes a rattle, you have to somehow earn the dog's eye contact. It's best if you do so with a deeper tone than normal, vocalization of a very staccato sort, so short, not a whole lot of verbal communication here, but clear, so loud, deep tone, short, and the dog should look at you knowing that's disapproval. That's not a happy voice from dad or mom. But some dogs may need to just be startled a bit. And with deaf dogs, for example, you may have to throw something soft in their general direction, but that will startle them and let them know that's not random, that's mom, that's dad, and look over it. Once you have earned their eye contact, your eyes must say to them, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. I don't want to see that again. You keep doing that, I'm going to come down there and bite your little nose right off. The imagery of the eyes has to be a believable, credible threat. That's what Mama Dog does. She looks at her puppies when they do something that she wants them to never do again, as if she'll rip them up, and her attitude is, no one's going to miss you. I'll have another litter, you know, next year, and then everything will be fine. Well, the puppies have to believe that this is a credible threat, or it isn't a communication of a prohibition. It might be excitement. It might be God knows what. But if it's not clear, and the clarity they need in doggy body language is, you're saying with your eyes and your very limited use of voice, hey, I never want to see that again. And it has to be much stronger than is natural for you as a primate. And in fact, what dogs do understand is the common language that we can share as social mammals and as mammals who've been living together for a very, very long time, though we're well adapted. We screw it up because we don't get the eyes right. And by eyes, I mean the upper half of your face. Your brow is as important to anything you want to say with your eye expression as the part below your eyebrows. So you've got to expose that to the dog and let the dog know, boy, I hate to see that. And as soon as you get the right response, you can stop. And the right response from the dog is wide open, round eyes, and kind of a withdrawn look on the face, a pulled back look on the facial muscles to say, oh my goodness, mommy, daddy is actually saying no to me about something. When they recognize that, when they acknowledge that, you can then look away, but it should be done in a scowly way. As if you still have an attitude like, yeah, you're darn tootin', you're not going to do that again. That's also not natural for us. It's necessary for the communication. That alone, the effective saying of no, would be a huge improvement in people's understanding of how to communicate with and motivate their dog.
That's Hawaii Island dog trainer and dog psychologist Carl Ogus talking to HPR's Russell Sumbiono. We'll continue our interview with Ogus right after the break.
Support for HPR comes from Legacy of Life Hawaii, dedicated to saving and enhancing lives through organ and tissue recovery, recognizing April as National Donate Life Month. Organ donor registration at registerme.org.
And mahalo to you, Nick, Pixie, and Jose. Let's get back to the conversation between Hawaii dog psychologist Carl Ogus and the conversation's Russell Sumbiono. Ogus has been talking about a modern way of training dogs that differs from some of the more heavy-handed techniques of the past. But sometimes training is not just for the dogs.
It sounds like training is just as much for the owner to understand how to communicate to the dog as it is for the dog to learn to obey commands.
I would say it isn't completely competent, truly, to only train the dog and hand it back to a handler, an owner, and say, now the dog is fixed. The dog's fixed vis-a-vis the relationship with the trainer. The dog isn't necessarily going to stay with the same norms if those norms are not in any way reinforced by the handler. The person who's with the dog every day is the person who does the homework, the person who does the day-to-day repeating of the training that makes it patterns the dog truly internalizes and will respond to naturally every time. So it's essential. The training should be done in the home. It's an important location for some of these habits. So I'm supportive of dog training Absolutely. An awful lot of dog trainers are not themselves that well trained. So we don't get very good advice, and we pay a lot of money for it.
It does seem like many things have changed in the last few decades in terms of our relationship with pets in general and how they are treated, and dogs are no exception. When I was growing up, I never saw a dog in a purse-sized carrier or being dressed up or being rolled around in a stroller or being referred to as children. What would you say has changed in how we perceive dogs, and why do you think that shift has happened?
I think that a lot of people who are either single or not fulfilled in their human relationships discovered that they could get a tremendous amount of fulfillment from the dog. But especially for many of these people, a dog who was not that demanding. And so one of the biggest needs, and by demanding, I just mean their natural needs to keep them happy and healthy. But one of the biggest needs dogs have is exercise. And one of the advantages of a very small dog is that your normal walking speed might make them truly trot along. We call it an amble. And if they have to amble or run slowly, they're getting aerobic exercise. And that's the kind they really need and that many, many dogs don't get enough of. So the irony of this is when people take their dogs out for walks and they don't want the dog messing around on the dirty ground or being exposed to dangerous dogs or dangerous squirrels or whatever it might be. And so they carry the dog or they have the dog in a stroller. It's tragic that people are treating the dogs too much like little babies and they think too much of their own comfort when it comes to the dog's day-to-day recreation, social life, and such. And they get a neurotic, very needy dog, which is very focused on mommy or daddy, and that's kind of what they want. But it's sad. It's not a good quality of life for that particular dog, not compared to what they might have had. It is helpful for the human. It's a type of service. So it has some legitimacy, although at some point, we have to acknowledge using other species for our benefit is not an obviously okay thing, morally speaking.
That was Carl Ogus of the Hawaii Dog Psychology Center talking to HPR's Russell Subiono. Ogus has been training dogs for 50 years, the last 20 of which were on the Big Island. He currently is working with the Hawaii Island Police Department to develop a program to train officers on how best to deal with dogs.